Welcome to Nothing Ventured, a podcast exploring some of the lesser heard stories in tech and venture. Join me, Arish Shah, as I speak to founders, investors, and ecosystem operators in the UK and beyond. Hello and welcome to Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today, I'm really excited to have with me Uliana Steibel. Uliana is co-founder and CCO of Highcastle, a professional equity and debt management platform. She's co-founder of Enkidu Global, a Swiss nonprofit which matches global financial donors and suppliers of medical goods with the medical needs of the medical procurement of Ukraine state enterprise. An Innovate Finance Women in FinTech Powerlist member, Uliana has previously held positions including policy officer for banking and financial service issues to the American Chamber of Commerce in Ukraine, executive director of the representative office in Ukraine for the Warsaw Stock Exchange, and head of FinTech at the 1991 Open Data Incubator. Uliana, welcome to the podcast. It's absolutely wonderful to have you here with us today.
Yeah, hello, Varish. It's a pleasure to be here.
Amazing. So let's dive straight in. This is a slightly different podcast today, as alongside some of the topics that we would normally cover, we really want to talk about the tech sector in Ukraine and the challenges in light of the aggression from Russia. For our listeners, could you give us an idea of how the sector has evolved over the last several years and where it has real strength right now?
Yeah, I definitely very happy to share the insights from the ground, even though I am based in London for the last couple of years, but have very strong connection with Ukraine and keep following the development of the ecosystem of startups in Ukraine. So like this ecosystem was really growing very rapidly in the last 10 years, I would say, especially 8-10 years, since we in Ukraine, we had the Euromaidan, the revolution of dignity. I think that was a very good period when all the changes and lots of new reforms have been starting. So businesses become really much more operating in much more free market economy. And that gave a huge like nudge to development of the IT sector. So from 2003 to 2020, like the whole IT system growing really rapidly. And in 2020, it's reached like IT outsourcing actually have reached about 10% of Ukraine export, which is roughly $5 billion per year. So quite a huge number. And obviously, when the Russia attacked Ukraine, and when the full invasion started in February, so the whole industry have been impacted dramatically. Lots of businesses had to find a new way how to operate and also have to relocate, first of all, their staff from the most dangerous parts of Ukraine. So now we see in Lviv, western part, it's where majority of the IT businesses are based now with their IT guys. Why I say guys, because actually majority, of course, are the male developers, even though like there are now pretty many of the Ukrainian women who also participate in IT sector, which is a very good sign, obviously. And western part of Ukraine is currently crowded with those companies relocated. Those who have been able to relocate abroad obviously did it. And actually, this was part of the compliance requirements of some of the clients of IT companies who were serving their foreign clients abroad. Because unfortunately, when it comes to compliance matters, on the first day of war, many of the clients have started to send the emails to Ukrainian IT outsourcing companies that they're suspending a contract. So basically, in the wartime, where foreign businesses really would be really nice if they can support Ukraine. So they were also kind of shocked and start to suspend the contracts. I think like this kind of change a little bit right now when things become a little bit more, I wouldn't say predictive, but at least more organized. But yeah, but still many of contracts are suspended and the sector is impacted really largely.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think there's a couple of points that are really important to kind of eke out there. So one is, I think, you know, this issue around women participating in the sector. I mean, there's been a slow burn, I think, across the globe, but we've seen obviously as a result of what's happening in Ukraine, women joining the military and participating, you know, on the ground against the Russian troops. And I have no doubt that that will continue to increase. And we're going to talk a little bit also about sort of what foreign businesses can do. And I guess your point is that if you have a foreign business that has operations in Ukraine and there are compliance issues, as you mentioned, then, you know, from a security perspective, they've needed to withdraw their staff and potentially any servers or any, you know, any systems that were being hosted locally in Ukraine, because obviously there is a risk that they fall into Russian hands or fall into the hands of bad actors. And what then happens is obviously quite, you know, potentially quite significant risk to those businesses. So just more specifically, like from your understanding of events on the ground, how have founders in Ukraine and the tech community in general there responded both to kind of the war as well as, you know, their ongoing kind of obligations or work, you know, as startups or as providers, services to startups? And what is the state of the startup ecosystem right now? Has it fragmented as a result of what's happened? Has it become actually more cohesive because there's a common kind of enemy, as it were? But give us a little bit of insight into what's happening right now.
Yeah, so I probably need to mention that actually, like in last couple of years, it's not just IT outsourcing sector, but also actually a product development, which increased in Ukraine, because you generally have like many senior developers coming from those outsourcing companies willing to build some nice products, right? So, and that's why like in a couple of recent years, we really seen a spark of startups ecosystem, nice products appearing. And by the way, we got a couple of Ukrainian unicorns like People.ai, GitLab, Grammarly, Ring. So probably you heard a couple of those names. And they're all having this software development offices. And those bigger companies, product companies, so who had the resources to do the relocation. So obviously they did their best to relocate people. And as I mentioned before, also relocate them abroad. So, but those companies which were not on a late stage of their development, having less resources, were the most impacted. So basically, when we talk about those early stage startups, those are really have been impacted the most. And Ukraine Startup Fund, this is a grant organization which is providing startup funding. They have been doing the research, like survey quite recently. They asked more than 100 startups in Ukraine about their current condition, how they feel, and what is this actually the stage of their business. And basically 99% responded that they heavily need financial support. And basically, like 41% said that they have no savings to keep working. But fortunately, also that 85% of those respondents answered that they know actually what they have to do. So there was like pretty good percentage saying that, okay, we know how to react and we know how to keep going. Unfortunately, of course, it's very much impacted, but again, by financial resources. But Ukrainian people are usually very creative and finding a way to overcome difficulties. So absolutely, many of those startups would try to keep, of course, serving. The first priority would be to continue serving clients. And of course, looking for new funding resources to maintain their business and to relocate, if possible, to other countries.
Yeah, I think ultimately, founders and startups have to be resilient and are often incredibly creative. And I have no doubt that in situations under extreme pressure, that creativity is, you know, really unchained. And as you say, these founders are having to find, you know, new and creative ways of sustaining their businesses. So on that point, for those in the UK and elsewhere that may have dev teams on the ground in Ukraine or have, you know, interests in startups in Ukraine, what is the best thing that they can do right now to support those teams? And what can larger international companies do?
So again, when we say about early stage startups, so the best the reaction currently is, of course, to provide some grant funding. And it's actually what Google did, because they provided 5 million grant funding to Ukrainian startups. Of course, it's an undergoing process. They are now accepting the applications. So startups have to be registered in Ukraine. They have each amount is not really huge, but it's actually quite a good number to support plenty of businesses. So I think like this is amazing example of corporate social responsibility. And as we would have more of those companies, corporates supporting IT and the startup ecosystem in this way, the better it would be for all of us. Because those startups who get this funding now, they can survive and most likely they will be relocated to other countries. And obviously, UK, US and other jurisdictions, they always have been very much interested in the flow of talents, new software businesses coming to the countries and generating, of course, the income for their economies, right? So I think like on the side of supporting early stage startups, it's obviously the grant funding is the best. And of course, from perspective of the foreign venture capital firms, so I think like the best they can do is, of course, continue investing in late stage businesses and those who already are at least reached seed or series A stage, because it's usually businesses who have been registered already somewhere abroad, but the R&D offices in Ukraine. So it's not that huge problem to relocate the business to the western part. It's a huge country. Right. So it means that there are plenty of space for those businesses actually to do this move and relocate their development offices to the western part where it is at least a little bit more calmer. But of course, all of those will require new investments and funding. So, yeah, this way of supporting businesses is the best. And wherever is possible for corporates or for other organizations actually to be more open to partnerships, the better. Because actually building a partnership for Ukrainian startup is also very, very, very much important. Like you can't penetrate international markets without having the strong use cases, strong partners, and sometimes really like pilots with those corporates. So my suggestion would be like really to look into those startups who are coming from Ukraine as an opportunity for innovation and for attracting and acquiring talents.
Yeah, I think it's almost a case of, if not doubling down, then certainly business as usual, right? I think from the perspective of anyone that is, you know, invested in or investing in startups in Ukraine, obviously there is the risk factor that needs to be brought in, you know, understood and brought into the picture. But equally, the brilliant thing about software is that they are potentially geographically agnostic, right? So ultimately, you know, it doesn't matter whether the business was founded in Ukraine, has a dev team in Ukraine, it may have, you know, may actually be servicing clients in the US or in Asia or in Australia or Africa for that matter, right? So I think, you know, as with all startups, capital is always key. Why? Because it ensures that people can continue to be employed and talent can continue to be deployed into these startups and these businesses. I think your point around, you know, Google having provided $5 million worth of grants to startups is amazing. Of course, Google has the ability to do that. Not everyone does. But equally, you know, there are other ways that companies like Google, I guess, or Microsoft or AWS for that matter, can provide services in kind, whether that's credits to their cloud platforms or indeed, you know, some of their services like G Suite or whatever it is called today and the Microsoft product suite, you know, those could be of massive value, you know, to startups, especially as they're having to like move from region to region and also given how important comms are. So I think for our listeners, you know, what I've taken from this sort of part of our conversation is that, you know, Ukrainians are resilient as we have seen already, you know, from the kind of military exposure that we're seeing on the news and elsewhere. But equally, the startup ecosystem is resilient. If people are needing to relocate, they are relocating. They're relocating to the Western regions in Ukraine. But don't turn off the taps, right? Capital needs to flow. Talent needs to flow. Whatever you can do to continue to support those businesses is going to be valuable. And as you mentioned, things like partnerships, pilots, et cetera, continue to be massively important because, you know, to stake the ground outside of Ukraine and make sure that, you know, they have the best chance of growing, then those partnerships become imperative. So thank you very much. I think that was a really useful kind of entry point into understanding more about what we can do in Ukraine. I'm sure there is far more that could be discussed as well. But to move on for a second, I'd really love to understand a bit more about you and what sparked your passion for fintech. Having moved from the policy side to the private sector, what were the challenges you faced and more importantly, the wins you're able to score? And one thing that always kind of, you know, is always a question in my mind is how can policymakers better engage with the startup ecosystem, in your opinion, especially in Ukraine and elsewhere for that matter? Because obviously, time and time again, we see policymakers and governments being slightly behind the curve in terms of what's actually happening on the ground in startup world. So yeah, I'd love to get your perspective on that. And as I say, what drove you towards fintech?
Yeah, in overall, just starting probably from my story. So I was, simultaneously working, doing my PhD and so kind of, you know, like working in finance, also working on my thesis in academia. And I personally always felt that it's much better to do something in real practice and not just be in a policies and or academia, because it's you with the corporate world, you see that the things are changing much more rapidly. You can have a much more rapid impact. And having a real impact, it's probably what drives me the most, right? And that's why I have been, in the end of the day, I choose to run a business versus in an academia of building a policies. I think like still up to a stage of a life, I probably can come back to the policy again, because it's still a very interesting field to be and then probably try to recover it from the inside and bring there a little bit more of the business practices. Because my overall impression about like governments and all of these foreign big institutions, it's of course very bureaucratic. Like I have seen it from inside. I have been doing actually my long time ago the internship in the United Nations in New York, and I have seen all of those bureaucracies which are not now when we need it doesn't work for Ukraine, because United Nations is very slow in their responses and their ability to react actually to what is going on in the world. So I think like the problem of that is actually that there is no much change from the inside, and change can be really bring only by people who come from market economy, who have business experiences, especially those who understand technologies, who can adopt technologies into organizations. So one of the examples like actually happened to me quite recently, because 2 months ago when the war started with the full invasion, so we, as all Ukrainians around the world, we started to kind of look into how we can react, help, and volunteer. And with friends, a group of Ukrainians, volunteers who are based mostly in London, we launched the initiative, which is called Enkidu. And we started to communicate with the medical procurement office in Ukraine about how to make a procurement faster for wartime, because lots of volunteers have been trying to procure some goods elsewhere, like without having the centralized approved needs from Ministry of the Health of Ukraine. So we started to cooperate with this division for procurement of medical goods, and it appeared to be that actually there are plenty of progressive people inside. And with a little help of people who have experience in business and technologies, so actually good things can happen. So in 2 months, we managed to introduce to this state agency SAP Ariba system. So SAP Ariba basically partnered and provided the technology to make a procurement faster. And Enkidu, on another side, is now helping to find the financial donors globally to finance those goods which already are approved and on demand by Ukraine.
So effectively acting as a marketplace, I guess, for the financial capital and the goods, right?
Yeah, kind of. We're actually launching the donor module. So again, technology which will help those financial donors to see those medical orders by government, right? Which are approved by this government institution. And I guess the best what we can do to automate those processes, to make them faster and more efficient, is of course to introduce technology. And that's how basically the policy, the government is partnering with this technology sector, or with us actually, like volunteers and initiatives which are coming from a volunteer sector and those people who have experience in doing business. So I think like it's really, really good example. And probably just to mention from, again, how I ended up in a fintech, that was absolutely the same story, because I saw the inefficiencies which have been existing, not even in the public sector, but actually on the, back on that time, I was working with the Warsaw Stock Exchange, which is partially government-owned. Actually, for 60%, they are owned by a Polish government. And you can imagine it's also like quite like big institution, which has a lot of the processes and not always reacting to the needs of the market with the speed which is required. So like my story started was quite long time ago, 2016. So basically I met my co-founder, who is a lawyer, and we had an idea to automate the secondary market for private stocks. Again, because I have seen like so many companies in Ukraine, in Eastern Europe, willing to raise funding, willing to provide a secondary market for their shareholders, but actually never wanted to go for IPO or for a stock exchange listing. And that's why we started to look into this field. And after a couple of years doing it, this kind of research and part-time being involved into this initiative, in 2020, the High Castle was born, and it's my company which I run currently. And basically High Castle is a solution which is addressing, first of all, a problem of digitalizing private securities. So later, there could be really a much more automated secondary market for private stocks.
So we're going to touch on this in a second. I just wanted to pause there because there's a couple of things that you said that, again, I think, you know, are worth just drawing out a little bit. So I think as you were talking, it's this constant dream of people to be able to change things, right? I think it's always a dream to come back from private sector and create change in the public sector. You know, we see that at the moment with a lot of sort of technology, you know, founders, you know, whether that's Zuckerberg creating initiatives around education, whether it's Facebook trying to solve internet access in India, or whether indeed it's, you know, Andrew Yang, you know, actually trying to run for president or for mayor of New York. These things ultimately, I think, can be quite difficult because, you know, there is this clash and friction between bureaucracy and the private sector. They do things very differently. Public sector is all about taking the cautious approach, whereas private sector is all about, you know, well, not necessarily all about, but it's certainly to a greater extent in the technology sector about, you know, risking things and learning very quickly to get to the right solution. So I can see that those two things can often be in conflict. I think your point around secondary markets is completely on point. I mean, we know that companies are taking longer to IPO, if they IPO at all, but there is this absolute need to be able to give liquidity to early investors, to employees, to founders for that matter as well. And you can only really do that if there's an efficient sort of secondary market. So actually, I kind of want to talk about that because I'd like to understand a little bit more about High Castle and understand who it's for, because it feels like there's quite a lot of these platforms out there at the moment, whether Seed Legal's Vested, Captable or Carta, which are the pure kind of, you know, cap table management systems, but equally Cedars, Carta again, which offer these secondary markets as well. What is it that differentiates High Castle and who's it for, as I say?
Yeah, so first of all, like, it's obviously that a demand and a market for this secondary market solution, it's actually quite huge. In the last couple of years, I have seen so many like different type of solutions trying to solve this problem in very different way. So there was even a boom of the blockchain-based kind of security token solutions for in 2018, 2019. And I don't think that any of them actually evolved to be a really huge or big one. So it's very questionable, like, actually what type of approach you take to resolve the secondary market problem. So, for example, just T0 was one of that kind of solutions in 2018-19, and they're still up and running in the United States. But in fact, what they do, they digitalize securities on a blockchain, and simultaneously they do the same thing on the central depository system. So there are lots of inefficiencies in the process, because if we want to have a proper digitalization on a blockchain or any kind of other type of technology in the public sector, so it means that actually the central securities depositories have to be digitalized, or there could be less monopoly on this type of institutions, right? So a new like decentralized systems could evolve. So it's quite interesting, of course, to go deeper into this problem. But another problem that we saw, like actually it's that there are a couple of models of having a secondary market. And for example, Carta and Cedars is totally different models, because what Cedar does, they have a marketplace, but they kind of regulate the price on the stocks, right? Not to have a drop into valuation of those companies. But in overall, like it's still quite an issue to have a proper secondary market and have a larger companies traded on those private exchange, let's say marketplaces or exchanges. While Carta managed to create a totally different system, it's actually also Nasdaq private market, which is going this direction. They focus more on secondary events such as tenders or auctions. And it seems to be that actually this type of solutions are working more relevant to the needs of the early stage investors, but also to the needs of those private equity funds who want to buy out those smaller stakes from early stage funds or early stage investors. So actually like tenders and auctions, they turn to be quite a good solution for a secondary market. But in order to have as a standard auction system, you have to have a properly digitalized securities, because previously they all have been on Excel spreadsheets. And we're not just talking about shares in a company. We also talk about like convertible notes, different type of debentures, options. And when you go deeper into how you deal with those different type of private securities, so it's plenty of the corporate actions which go around these securities, like exercise of option, like conversion of those debt securities.
Yeah, or even the seniority, right, in different share classes or debt, etc. Like all of those, as a CFO, those cause headaches on a daily basis. So I can completely understand, you know, a platform that actually deals with those can be quite valuable. Again, many, many startups certainly, you know, until they get to quite later stages, don't have that complexity built in. But I guess once they start getting to those later stages, where, as you say, you have multiple employee options, you may have preference stacks, you may have bank debt, you may have venture debt, all of this stuff, you know, convertible notes, etc., that all starts becoming quite complicated. And actually trying to figure out the waterfall to create, at a liquidity event can be incredibly difficult, let alone trading kind of on the secondary market.
Yeah, I would say like as a cap table management solution, we always recommend, of course, startups to get to the platform as soon as possible, free of charge for early startups, because it actually makes much more sense to started properly from scratch and not to migrate all of this wrong data, because actually we have seen plenty of those startups who are reaching a deal with investors on a seed or Series A stage, and then they having huge troubles with all that messy cap tables, not properly executed share certificates, share certificates numberings, and then they actually pay £400 per hour to their lawyers to fix those things, right? So it's cost much more higher than simply have a software solution in place. So I think like just answering back your question about like what makes Hightcastle different, obviously like a need and a market is huge. But what we also address as a platform, we also addressing a full cycle of the solution for a company. So we actually providing a software where companies can come with a need to find investors, so to manage their investor pipeline, utilize our internal built-in kind of CRM system to manage their investor pipeline, then turn them to the confirmed investors and keep management of a list of those confirmed investors on the order book, sign documents. So basically, Highcastle has a data room solution to share and sign documents to go through the diligence. And immediately from this interface, actually to issue those share certificates directly to the cap table. And later, of course, to have a secondary market opportunities such as private transfers or liquidity events. And because like companies don't need all of the solutions simultaneously, they generally need them like each one on some period of time of their life cycle. So it means that actually like we want them to have all of those things in one place and not be inviting the investors to, first of all, to many platforms, like 7 or 8 platforms that, where they invite the shareholders and investors, but also because it actually makes so much sense to have it all in one place. And for CFO, it's of course a very nice place to a home for their corporate matters.
Yeah, I mean, I was just nodding along throughout what you were saying there, because I've been in a number of businesses where we've had to migrate from a spreadsheet to a platform solution. Often the data is incomplete. We've had to recall share certificates, reissue them. You have all sorts of problems that can arise. I'm fortunate enough, having been through this problem myself, I started with a platform solution, not Highcastle, though I think I will definitely have a look at it, but a rather simple one I can just use whilst my cap table is relatively clean. One of the things that I think is probably the most complex issue is when you have, you know, employee options across geographies, when you have potentially shareholders across geographies, or where you have, you know, top co's, but sub co's as well, both of which have shares issued. I think all of these things, as you say, there are many, many problems that need to be solved within this framework, but not all of them are needed from day one, right? And I think a platform that allows you to kind of stack those solutions on top of each other as and when you need them is really valuable. So I'll certainly be checking out Highcastle myself. But look, just as we wrap up, Uliana, this podcast is called Nothing Ventured for a reason. We really believe that backing yourself is one of the most liberating things you can do, and it can teach you a lot about yourself. And one of the things that you are passionate about is, you know, fundraising for immigrant founders who are often sort of entrepreneurs out of necessity. They have no choice but to back themselves. Can you talk us through why that's important to you and how you think we could improve that flow of dollars to this over, you know, often overlooked cohort?
Yeah, so I think like being an immigrant founder myself, it showed me like lots of inefficiencies, of course, which are existing as well in the way how immigrant founders are treated and trusted, I would say. So I think like in overall, like UK is doing amazing job. Myself, I'm also an exceptional talent visa holder. So it's definitely giving opportunity for foreign founders to come and run their business in the UK. I think it could be a little bit more programs, right, for those early stage founders who the state wants to attract from other countries, because usually they wait with open arms those who are already growing, but it's very little funding actually for early stage companies who are really struggling of being like a foreigner in a country. So I think like my mission, of course, is to support as well those businesses who are coming, especially from Ukraine. We see it right now. I'm consulting many of the early stage startups who are discovering their opportunities in the UK, how to establish business, how to attract funding. We are supporting some of those businesses in their fundraising through Highcastle solutions. So as I mentioned, helping them to manage their investor pipeline and educate them a little bit how to communicate with investors, how to be appealing to the investors, what criteria to meet when they approach investors. So obviously, we focus on helping and consulting those businesses. But what I would, again, wish to see is, of course, a little bit more openness from local VCs as well to those businesses, because obviously those founders who made their way to the UK or other countries, so they already have this like a pretty developed background, being like doing something and actually sometimes doing those things 10 times more, better and harder because you are coming from totally different environment, right? Speaking different language and all of those things. So I think like immigrants, founders in overall, very hardworking. And obviously that's what motivates me to support these founders and give them chance to become really successful.
Yeah, I think it's massively important. I think in the US, when you look at a lot of, you know, the large cap technology businesses, they are, if not founded by, certainly now currently being run by migrant founders. For some reason, a lot of them are from India, if you look at some of the bigger ones. But equally, you know, here in the UK, I think to your point, and this is a problem not just with migrant founders and immigrant founders, but equally just the ecosystem in general. Pre-seed is a really tough place to track capital. You need to have network, you need to have, you know, relationships with angels and high net worths or family members who are potentially able to back you, which obviously a lot of people and a lot of founders certainly do not have. And is probably one of the main things that turns those founders away from building businesses. And I think, yes, that, you know, the state absolutely could play a large part here. Although there's always this fine line to be trod between the state taking part or having influence versus taking part, let's say, as we're seeing with things like the Future Fund, right? Like it isn't, whilst the mechanism used seemed appropriate, like having the state on your cap table is not necessarily the best idea. And we see these problems in Europe as well as the UK and elsewhere. But I think, you know, especially given a post-Brexit environment where we are potentially attracting fewer migrants to our universities and so on, it is important that we encourage as many as possible to come here. And okay, you know, if we are going to live in an environment where we have a point system for migration or where we have, you know, special access visas, then we should absolutely be targeting, you know, people who are going to be building and driving the economy, because I think, you know, obviously that is the best way to bootstrap everyone around us. So I absolutely fully endorse your passion. I think, you know, funding of underrepresented communities, whether it's, you know, immigrants, whether it's female founders, whether it's those that come from diverse ethnicities, I think is massively important and, you know, very telling. And I was reading a report from Crunchbase earlier today where whilst, you know, funding grew to these sectors, you know, over the last couple of years, it was because overall funding had grown, right? So there's more dollars being deployed. So therefore, more dollars were deployed. But as a percentage, it was either stagnant or had actually declined in some cases. So, you know, I think there's still a lot of work to be done. Uliana, it's been absolutely wonderful having you here on the podcast with me today. Thank you so much. For our listeners, where can they find you? Are you on Twitter? Are you on LinkedIn? Where's the best place for them to look for you online?
Definitely LinkedIn, Twitter. Please do not hesitate to just to contact me. So the LinkedIn would be the best. And really thank you for having me on this podcast. It's very nice to have this talk and share with the audience those insights which I have from Ukraine.
No, it's been absolutely wonderful. Thank you so much and have a great day.
Thanks for listening to Nothing Ventured, an Emerge One production. We'd love to get your feedback and thoughts on our conversations, as well as topics or guests you'd love to hear from. Drop me a line on social media or via one of the links in the show notes. I mean, what have you got to lose, right?